I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, folks, tomorrow, the University of New Orleans becomes LSU New Orleans, back to its original roots. The university was originally founded in 1958, actually the year I was born, as LSU New Orleans, and it adopted the name of UNO in 1974 and went under the UL system, but now it's back into the LSU system as of tomorrow. And Jeanette Weiland, LSU New Orleans Interim Chancellor and Chief Administrative Officer, joins us to talk about the transition. Jeanette, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Noel. How are you?
Doing great. I guess the day is finally here, right? Tomorrow.
You have no idea. Yes, we have been revving up to this day. And then it's just so funny because, yes, that will pass. And then we have to just keep the momentum going and keep accelerating on the gas pedal. We've got to drive that enrollment and keep shooting for the stars. So the work will not end after tomorrow, let me tell you.
No, and in the end, it really is all about enrollment, right?
Absolutely. And this is such a timely call because a couple of hours ago, I sat in on a meeting with my CFO, our vice president of enrollment, and one of our math professors who's been with UNO for probably 30 plus years, Tumulish. And Tumulish is brilliant and used to be part of an initiative back in 2017-ish kind of days where they really analyzed retention rates and where we were recruiting our students from locally. And he had a ton of data. We really just dug into about 10 years worth of data. And then it was such good data that we can really act upon and go back to some best practices that used to be in place, along with some new ones. So we in real time pulled in our new director of admissions and enrollment, Mr. Jalen Carter, who shamefully I poached from Tulane. He's brilliant. And so we all got in a room and we were looking at this stuff and we're coming up with some action items and implementation plans and retention committees to involve faculty and all sorts of folks from around the university to really make sure that every effort and every resource that we're putting towards admissions and enrollment is going toward the right places, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Jeanette, young adults are starting to declare where they're going to attend. I mean, do y'all have any data or any trending that you're following at the present time?
I don't have that data at hand right now, but yes, we could get it. Our admissions team knows all of that. We are late in the cycle, to your point, but at UNO, and we're not alone in this in terms of universities across America, but probably about 25% of our enrollment actually happens right before classes start, which is why I just never report out on our numbers because they'll just be too misleading at this point. We've been looking, but the data that we looked at today in terms of where we have historically recruited students from, or I should just say where they're coming from locally, we had three tiers of local high schools, regional high schools, top 30, a middle group, and then a below 30 or something like that. And for any school in the region that we accepted less than 20 students from that school, we just took them out of the data set altogether so that we were hoping that all of the, the data sets would be relevant in terms of our overall enrollment. But I could babble on about this forever. I don't know if you want to know specifics, but...
No, I mean, I think, it's really, in the end, it's really about saving the university. I mean, when we talk about, and so many of us that, attended UNO, I was part-time, 11 years part-time at night. I had a lot of folks maybe weren't there as long as I was, but were there a long period of time. And it played a major role in their success. I mean, I found another book that Professor Ambrose wrote, and I didn't even realize he had authored this book. It's called Ike Spies. My mother-in-law went to UNO as well late in life, and she took one of his classes, and he had signed it to her, and we were moving some stuff, and I found it, and it's just so many fond memories of the time there. didn't feel so fond at the time, but when you look back at it, you know, you realize you realize the important role that it played.
Oh my gosh, Newell, exactly. So for me personally as well, to your point, I remember crying a lot. I mean, I was going full-time at night while working full-time during the day because, I mean, as affordable as the tuition was, I had to take out student loans for everything, which I'm very proud. I just paid them off a few years ago. But yeah, so I was trying to get it done as fast as possible. Whereas if you talk to like President Roos from LSU, he took the maximum amount of time to finish his master's degree at night. I think he said he took one course per semester. So he spread it out. I think he had a company paying for it. But it was at UNO. UNO is where I learned, you know, from debating in class and from learning from my professors, that there is no difference between profitability goals between a nonprofit like a university and a for-profit business. And the only difference is where those profits go. Do they go into shareholder pockets or do they go back into the mission of the organization? So, I mean, yeah, my degrees at UNO and my experience there completely transformed my life, shaped my future. I'll speak to that tomorrow during our ceremony. And two of my absolute best girlfriends to this day, I met in grad school there pre-Katrina. So to your point, I'm not the only one. You're not the only one. We have tons of alum who have been affected and touched by UNO. It was a great middle class, you know, type university. It was affordable, but a high quality education. And I spoke a little bit about the data because we're losing. We even saw data around the average income, household income of the students over this 10-year period. And we're losing out on that middle class sector locally in Louisiana. And I don't know how to describe why or when. I mean, I can see when it shifted. There's probably multiple root causes of that, but we're going to get back there because the reality is in our region, we have phenomenal community college systems. We have Nunez, we have Delgado. They do their part. And I feel like our university kind of crept into that lane a little bit where we're doing a disservice to students if they're not prepared for a four-year institution yet coming out of high school. So we shouldn't be accepting students who are more applicable for the community college experience before transferring to a four-year if that's what they want to do. So we need to get back to the role that we should serve as the public research institution for the New Orleans region.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I had someone from the Fordham Institute on my show the other day, and I read a lot of what they produce. And they were talking about how we have such diverse pathways now of so many ways to get through higher ed, right, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But it seems that the data is revealing that we're not really finishing the moment, so to speak, where they actually leave employable, you know, and they get a job. You know, and that seems to be cropping up to the, you know, to be a top of mind issue as people look at, like you did, you know, the debt that you have to carry when you leave, and then you have to go service that debt, and you're like, well, wow, I can't get a job, you know?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm very excited about all of this subject matter, quite frankly. I'm so in it right now. But, you know, to your point, I love that we're still affordable. And when we look at our tuition rates, you know, compared to the entire state, you know, the public institutions, at least, we don't even want to go there with the privates. They're so expensive. But, and then even nationally, I mean, we're competitive on that lane. But more importantly, the quality of our education is legit. I mean, our professors are phenomenal instructors. Our professors are earning highly competitive national research grants, and our undergrads get to experience the research part of learning as well. And then I just had a one-on-one probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago with Sergio, who runs our career services center. And to your point, employability and getting our students access on the front end immediately starting freshman year all the way through graduation to internships with our local industry is going to be a very high priority because they'll be that more likely, and the probability of them having employment opportunities post-graduation if they've already been exposed and have had those internship opportunities all along will be much higher. My personal goal, I think, I don't know if we talked about this last time I was on the show, but I would love to see us recruit a ton of students from out of state as well. Again, back to the price point, we're competitive. We are in an urban city that, for lack of better words, is just cool. I mean, we've got culture. We've got professional sports teams. I mean, we have everything here. And so people want to be here, and we need to leverage that. And my ultimate goal, and maybe this is me just going back to my economic development days, I want to recruit those students. I want to keep those students. I want to graduate those students, and I want to make sure they stick and grow our population. Because, you know, you can speak in terms of Orleans Parish, the region, or the state. We have a population problem, a big one. We're losing our brain power. Mm-hmm. We can't make enough babies fast enough. That's not physically possible. I want to see us grow from a tax base perspective to help solve a lot of our infrastructure problems that affect our quality of life for everyone at every level. And that's the role that and universities can play.
Well, that's the role they at one time had played, right? I mean, it was a major move. I don't know how we kind of moved away from it. I don't think it was necessarily the university's fault or position. I think there were a lot of external forces that caused that to happen. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I say this all the time. I'll only speak to UNO because I haven't worked at every university around here, but we had a leadership problem, and I'm going to compete very hard for the permanent chancellor position because I know in my heart and in my mind and in my gut that, you know, when you have a resume like mine where you've touched different facets of life, where you've been a business owner, where you've taken a step back in your career to learn new skill sets, to further your career in the long run, even though it's painful in the short run, you know, that's the kind of mindset and perspective you need as a leader to run a university that is multifaceted and is supposed to be a workforce engine, a research engine and a workforce engine. And I think from a leadership perspective, we've had folks who have, you know, they're very well educated to, you know, terminal degrees and all that jazz, but in one discipline. And their resume has been in one industry, academia. And again, universities are multifaceted organizations. They're complex. I mean, working up to this point, and this is like a commercial for myself right now, but I think it's relevant to what you're saying. I've managed HR teams. I've managed facilities. I've written grants and earned federal funding myself. I've managed marketing teams. I'm a finance person. Like, the only thing I didn't have coming in was the athletics piece. And man, oh man, I'm learning a lot. I've learned a ton about athletics departments in the last 6 months. And I mean, and part of leadership is putting a great team in place. And oh my gosh, that's what gets me so pumped. I've got Gio leading athletics. He is not only the most solid, wonderful human being, but in terms of his core competencies and his skill sets, it doesn't get any better than a man like him. And then Eddie Williams Jr., I mean, hiring him to build our first marching band since the 1970s, look at that man's resume. And when you spend time with him, again, a wonderful person who cares about the students, cares about student success, understands that the culture and the student experience are so impacted by what he's building. My CFO's dynamite. I mean, my woman that we're about to announce that's now running our foundation and fundraising efforts, you don't find a better personality and go-getter and entrepreneurial spirit than her. Like, so this team is going to take this university to new heights, and I'm sure you can tell. I'm very excited.
Well, I'm excited about it as well, because I think, you know, at one point in time, that was all there. We had a very strong adjunct professors there that brought real life experiences, you know, to the student experience. And I love that. And, you know, and it was kind of unique at the time. Right.
And yes, and I love having instructors that have that. Yeah, I know that the instructors, when they have that industry experience, it's so powerful in the classroom. So right now, like literally before I jumped on this call, I'm signing a letter to hire a professor of practice in civil engineering to teach in our urban construction management program. And that person still wants to keep working in industry. And so we're not going to hire them as a full FTE. We're going to hire them as a 0.75 FTE. But yes, to get to your point, people like that in the classroom teaching with real life experience mixed with their formal education and their accolades, it's the best combination.
Yeah. And how important is that now? You know, I mean, technologies are changing so fast. I mean, you know, something that was announced 6 weeks ago today might be almost antiquated in some respect. I mean, it's crazy the speed that it moves.
You're right. I mean, like AI just as one piece of technology, you know, we're seeing that incorporated as a tool. So I'm seeing our professors talk about it in different, all across the disciplines. So in all four colleges, they're kind of looking at it. No one, I mean, some people might try to avoid it. You know, we're like that as humans when new things pop up. But the fact of the matter is, it's a tool. And so if we don't learn how to flex and use that tool with our students, then we're just going to be behind. But yeah, no, we have some really, from a technological perspective, I spent a couple hours with our computer science department probably a month ago and saw what interesting things they were up to from a research perspective. And they've got contracts with like the Army Corps of Engineers. They've got drone technology and submersible robots that go through, you know, some of our pipes and our systems, or the drones, of course, are aerial, but they're helping our federal government and federal partners solve problems, or even, you know, they're using their technology to predict problems before they arise, like inspecting the levees. I mean, things that are really impactful for folks who don't even realize it's happening.
We're visiting with Jeanette Weiland, LSU New Orleans Interim Chancellor and Chief Administrative Officer. How important is your UNO Foundation? I know there are a lot of alums that are involved, and also the beach plays a, I guess y'all still have a strong nexus connection to what's happening there.
We do. So the foundation, and I like to refer to them as the University Advancement Team, but they are crucial. So they were kind of cut off at the knees a year ago. And so we are in the midst of, again, like I said, we hired the leader. Now she's building her org chart. She's filling in those vacancies, and she's doing a great job of immersing herself and her teammates into all the academic departments and the athletics department, and trying to figure out where their resources should be spent in terms of fundraising. Our goal is to you know, hit about, we want them to raise the equivalent of about 6% of our operating budget, which is going to be about $100 million. So, that, you know, so we have some sort of metrics built, but it's going to take a little bit to rev up. In terms of the Research Tech Park, because that's going to be renamed to the LSU New Orleans Research Tech Park, they are rocking and rolling. They provide a tremendous service to the university, experiential learning opportunities, pitch competitions, coaching. They assist our faculty members who have new discoveries to help them go through the commercialization process to get their technology not just, you know, on paper or in a theoretical state, but actually transfer it into the commercial sector where it can be applied to solving real-world problems. So they've been a great help, and we're going to have a big announcement probably towards the end of July from the corporate sector, who is investing millions of dollars into some teaching and research facilities in the Research Tech Park in collaboration with our faculty. So there's going to be good stuff coming. But to your point, those entities are critical for a thriving, innovative university like ours.
I've attended the last probably four or five, maybe even more, the Alumnus of the Year banquet, Distinguished Alumni banquet that's held. And I'm always simply amazed by how influential UNO graduates are, not only here in the state of Louisiana, not only in our region, but around the world. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely incredible, the breadth and depth of our alumni from that university. And it just blows me away when I look at that list and what people have accomplished, inventors and just in every walk of life, right?
I agree. And we have some great ones coming up this year, because I just attended the luncheon where they vote on who the next ones are going to be. So you'll see more of that. To your point though, Noel, we need to tell that story. So pretty soon we're going to post a position probably in about a month for a new director of our alumni association, because we'd love to see some new energy with that group and get them better organized and more effective. They're dying to be, you know, our alum are dying to be part of our campus and interact with our current students. So anything we can do to support that activity, we're going to do. You know,
well, I'll make this commitment to you. I would love to interview these folks, because I am just completely intrigued and enamored by some of their accomplishments are huge.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
And I was looking. I have a pamphlet that I had, and I can't find it right now. It's in the mess of my office. But I was looking at it just the other day, and I was like, you know, this was wow. I mean, you know, it's just absolutely incredible. We hear about, you know, the Tulane grads and others, and not a whole lot of the UNO grads. So I would love to highlight and showcase those individuals.
Well, you have my word. I will make sure my team gets a list to you of all the winners of those alumni awards over the past few years so that you can kind of see the breadth and the depth, as you described, of those folks. And we'll definitely try our best to get you in touch with them. Tomorrow, during July 1st, we're going to show a video that I asked our director of the School of the Arts to produce. He's a film faculty member. And he made this entire video with students. And when I showed it to President Roos and some others as a sneak preview, they thought this video came from some, you know, agency, like a firm outside that we paid a lot of money for. And I said, no, we paid them a very small amount of money. And this is our talent producing these stories that kind of, these pieces that tell the stories. And so this one tomorrow will be all about our faculty. And what I would love to do soon is to create our own little in-house homegrown production company, so we don't go outside as much because we can't afford to outside agencies, but really just utilize our faculty talent and our current students to produce the content, to your point, to tell these stories and boast about everything we have going on, because it's real.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations. Tomorrow, the big day, the formal transition to LSU New Orleans. Best of luck to you. And give me that list. Love to get started on it.
Yes, sir. Will do. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Jeanette Weiland, LSU New Orleans Interim Chancellor and Chief Administrative Officer, And tomorrow's the day, July 1. UNO's boot formally changed to LSU New Orleans. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
Folks, we've been hearing a lot about what's going on in Decatur Street, and I remember probably several months back walking back from having dinner down at the Italian Barrel back up to Jackson Square, coming across all of that construction and how kind of dangerous it was. And I wondered then how these businesses were surviving, and it turns out they really weren't. And joining us to talk about that is Glade Bilby, president of French Quarter Citizens and co-chair of Save Our Soul Coalition Armstrong Park, also commissioner of the French Quarter Management Commission, and an accomplished photographer in his own right. As my wife of 35 years said yesterday, that I had a face for radio. Well, it turns out as a photographer, Glade made it a face to be sheriff. So he did great work. He even made me look halfway decent.
Thank you, Noel, for that shout out. I appreciate it. I have that same face for radio, by the way.
It's funny, the things that we talk about. That you know, when I saw that you were coming on today, I was like, I'm going to have to remind him about that.
Well, it's my annuity, you know, all those pictures that I've taken for decades and decades. It's sort of like that. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. All right. Let's talk about what's going on in Decatur Street. It's a mess. It's been a mess. It's a complete mess that this administration has inherited, and they're trying to do something with it. But it's almost as if there's not a lot of options, huh?
No, there's not. And it's exciting to see that they've stepped up and recognized some of the problems. You can't see, we really don't need any more businesses that don't exist anymore. I mean, we've had that happen throughout the quarter, that something works and then all of a sudden it doesn't for some reason. But I think this French Quarter Business Stabilization Fund is really a good effort to help out. We really rely on all these small businesses in the quarter. You know that the quarter is the economic engine for not just the city, but this entire region. So we really need to do everything we can to help them out.
Well, you know how much I love the quarter, and every time it ends up in a state of distress, whether it's one block, two blocks, or otherwise, it really impacts the entire quarter, right?
It does, and I you have to think about it. We're geographically limited in the French Quarter. It's not like some other bigger cities that are more spread out. And we're also old, 250, 300 years old. So we're going to need to be fixing infrastructure problems forever. And this is just one of those things that we have to do. The key to it is maybe doing it better, doing it in a little more transparent way that doesn't impact multi-blocks at the same time. And I think this is bringing these issues to the fore where we need to come up with a better plan, because we're going to be fixing infrastructure for a long time in the quarter, just by virtue of a couple of things. And one of them is the age, but the other one is 19 plus million tourists a year coming through here. Puts a tremendous burden on us here.
It seems as though consistency and coordination just hadn't been, you know, prevalent here, right? I mean, and that's why we find ourselves in the position that we find ourselves in right now.
We are, but I've talked to Steve Nelson a couple of times, and I think he's got a vision that will be better. And you have to deal with the status quo. You can hope and hope and hope, but that's not really the best plan. So putting a better plan in place going forward, using whatever we've learned from this process, is gonna work for us. It has to work for us. We all do these things, whether it's French Quarter Citizens, VC Poor, French Quarter Management District. All these organizations do things to improve the quality of life, to do things to make life better for the residents, of course, and for the visitors to come here. We want them to come back. We want them to spend money. We want them to have a good, safe time. So all of these things are to that end, which is very positive.
Yeah. What's going to make matters, I think, maybe hopefully better, but maybe potentially worse, is that we now have litigation that's been filed by a number of business owners, and I can understand the frustration. I mean, they're watching their whole future kind of melt away right before them.
Well, you know, you're in business to do what? To do business. And so I think these people were just frustrated. I mean, this is not unlike what, for instance, doing a little research on this, Austin has a plan, a construction impact relief grant program, that they do a similar thing. Now, they're not geographically limited like we are, but I mean, this is not unusual where you want to help out the small businesses because you need to improve the infrastructure. And I really feel badly for all of it. Well, look, in front of my house, they came and put new gas lines in. They said 4 to 6 weeks. It was 18 weeks. So you couldn't park, you couldn't anything, piles of dirt, trucks, construction. So everything takes longer. I want to tell anybody, want something to do, just buy an old house, because every time you touch something, there's five things under that you need to repair. So this is going to be a problem for a long time. It just, you need a process to make it work going forward with a backup plan or two. And I think that's what will come out of this eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to some of the business owners that said that you could build a Costco faster than they were able to deal with the drainage on their block, which is telling, you know, because you have private sector motivated by, you know, time is money for the private sector, and so you have that coordination that's going on, and you're not going to miss it. You know, you're going to dot every I, cross every T, and you're not going to miss a deadline.
Well, time is money, whether it's your money or my money, it's still money. So I think this is a consideration that we have to plan for in this city. And as we've talked about a lot in the past 6 months, we have financial issues that we have to deal with. We just cannot keep building things with no end in sight, with no deadline, and without transparency. You have to tell the businesses and the residents. You know, no, there's the businesses on the bottom, but in the Creole tradition, there's residents above. So what affects the businesses is also affecting all the people that live here. So it's not just the businesses that we're hearing about. It's the people that live here as well.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because for some folks, for months on end, they haven't been able to take a traditional path to their home. You know, they've been detoured around to get to their front door.
Right. And, you know, we are a living neighborhood in the French Quarter that reflects our heritage. So sometimes we get past that. And we don't even know that. It's the parties and it's the restaurants and it's the bars and the music, which is great. But it relies on a lot of the restaurants, the residents here, keeping up the properties and keeping up the sidewalks in front of their properties. It's not all businesses. And I'm in the back of the quarter, so we're more of a neighborhood and more residents. And I think if people remember that, they'll be, one, more respectful, and then more appreciative of what we have here as a heritage. You know, we're going into 250 years in America. We're 300 years old. This city started a long time ago, and a lot of traditions of building and cultures, French, Spanish, Creole, Caribbean, all came and started in the French Quarter. So I think you kind of lose sight of the history reflected in our architecture that also reflects our culture as well. So it's important.
Yeah, no doubt, for sure. As always, we always enjoy the conversation. You know, our heart goes out to these businesses, and hopefully they're able to stay the course, stay in business. So many have already gone by the wayside, but we really can't afford to lose too many more for certain, and hopefully there's an end in sight.
No, and with the focus on it, I think it will be better, and now that there's plenty of eyes on it, it's going to be better. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
And you guys got the big Fourth on the River celebration.
Yes.
Coming up
exciting.
As well. And that it looks like hopefully we'll have good attendance for that as well. I think the quarter needs it, right?
It's a quarter. We always have good attendance. Come on.
Absolutely. Was there last night, actually, and always enjoy my time down there. Glade Bilby, president of the French Quarter Citizens and co-chair of SOS and commissioner on the French Quarter Management Commission. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And have a great weekend.
You too, Neil. Thanks a lot.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, you'll hear true stories that will intrigue you, inspire you, and make you laugh.
He said, is there anything in your diet that might be spiking your blood sugar? I said, sometimes I eat pizza until I'm unconscious. He said, I think that might be it.
For real stories live on stage from comedians, astronauts, accountants, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, as it turns out, the French are now wanting to investigate Americans for homicide as a result of the over 1,000 people dying in the last 3 days in Paris because of the heat wave, about 104 degree Fahrenheit, because they don't have air conditioning. And mostly the folks that have passed on are elderly folks, but the deputy mayor there in Paris, I believe that's their position, is saying that it's because of our overabundance of air conditioning, that our cities are 90% air conditioned. And if you believe this is unrelated to this heat wave that Paris is having, you don't really know what you're talking about. So the deputy mayor, Audrey Pulvar, on Instagram blames this whole crisis on U.S. carbon emissions. And the only problem is none of the data supports anything of what they're saying. And they don't like the fact that we are pointing out, is like, why do you not have air conditioning? And why is it that you have to go get a special permit and only certain people can have air conditioning in Paris? You see the same thing in London and in Great Britain. where you just can't decide for oneself, well, I think I want to air condition these rooms. You got to go to government to get permission to air condition spaces in private residences, in these countries. And all of a sudden, it's our fault because we have air conditioning here. It's kind of interesting. Everything ends up with the U.S. being the scapegoat, which is even more so interesting when you talk to folks that are here. And I've seen these interviews for the World Cup, and I've said this many times on the show over the past several days, how much people really are enjoying themselves and really are enamored with the way that we live, the way that we conduct ourselves. And they're like, we don't have the capability, we don't have the availability of most of what y'all have here and what you enjoy here. And they are bragging about the country. They're bragging about the experience. They're bragging about what they're able to take advantage of while they're here. And what's interesting is they're recognizing the freedoms that they have as a guest, much less as a citizen. But the French want to blame their heat-related deaths on us. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. Folks, don't forget that WWL and Riverfront Marketing Group invite you to go forth on the river. Join us for an historic Independence Day celebration along New Orleans Riverfront with a world-class free fireworks display this Saturday, July 4th. Starts at 9 p.m., the fireworks, that is. Come out early to enjoy the pleasures of the French Quarter and downtown New Orleans hotels, museums, restaurants, and bars. Then grab a great viewing spot from either bank, including the brand-new Gold Ring Woldenburg Riverfront Park. Be there when we light up the skies and celebrate America's 250th birthday. Go forth on the river from the Riverfront Marketing Group, WWL, and our sister station, Magic 101.9. Scoot joins us, I believe. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Yeah, I'm just relaxing in my office. Realized it was time, and I ran down the hall. It's quite a jaunt to my office. Oh, okay.
It is.
So I'll try
it's
to
catch my 100-yard dash.
Boy, you should see how far the bathroom is. You know that, right? You got to yes. Go to the bathroom before you really need to go to get there in time. All right. So we're going to talk about America, the 250th birthday, and the Supreme Court ruling about birthright citizenship. So we'll talk about all that coming up.
Scoot's headed your way. Have a great Tuesday evening. We'll see you again in the morning.
Are you looking for a pro football podcast that doesn't put you to sleep with spreadsheets or insult you with mindless hot takes? Football is fun. Why shouldn't your football podcast be the same?
Follow and listen to Heed the Call NFL podcast with Dan Hanzus and Mark Sessler wherever you get your podcasts.